This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith about global sociology, and particularly the question of, is there hope for Uncle Sam beyond the American bubble? We're going to find out about that with our guest today on Keeping the Faith. We have a professor of sociology from the University of Illinois, Jan Nettervein Petersa. Mm-hmm. Welcome. Did I get the name right?
Thank you, Steve. Just fine.
Thank you. I'll call you Jan if that's all right.
Sure, please.
And for our listeners, that's spelled J-A-A-N. And Nettervein is the first part of your hyphenated last name is N-E-D-E-R-V-E-E-N, and then a hyphen, and then P-I-E-T-E-R-S-E. So listeners who might like to read some of the books you've published can find that more easily. But let's talk about one of your areas of concern is global sociology. Where did you come up with the question that's the title of your next book, Is There Hope for Uncle Sam?
A friend gave it to me.
Ah.
Manfred Steger, political scientist.
Okay.
Originally, I had the title, Can the United States Correct Itself?
Okay.
Plain, straightforward title, but a little bit severe, a little stern, or a little bit school teacherish.
But both titles assume that the United States is in trouble.
I think, yes, they do.
Okay, let's talk a little bit just about that first. Your subtitle of this upcoming book is Beyond the American Bubble. What is this bubble?
The bubble is the American comfort zone of discourse. And all cultures, all societies have their own comfort zone, their own cultural continuum in which some things are common sense and other things are simply out. And in the American case, if you take into account it's a large country, geographically apart, isolated, historically it also stands apart. So we have size, we have remoteness, and we have historical rupture or break. So all of these give certain boundaries to the American field of discourse. And it becomes a comfort zone in which Americans feel comfortable. And in that comfort zone, certain things are easily talked about, and other things, well, they never come up.
Mm. And part of that field of discourse is the self-image that Americans have, I take it.
It is.
Okay. And some things are never talked about. What are some of those things that are talked about typically?
For example, Steve, if people in the United States think of politics, they often think of elections. When they think of elections, they think of numbers.
Right.
When they think of numbers, they think of horse race.
Right.
And there is an enormous preoccupation then with the numbers.
How many delegates? Right.
All sorts of numbers, sure. Lots of numbers, and every day fresh, new numbers, right. Numbers, personalities, character. Then, after some silence, there is talk of policies. Now, what is not talked about is more the political process and the institutions.
Hmm. Now, when you, as a sociologist, and your purview is the whole globe, it's global sociology. How did you decide to focus at this time on this book, and you've written many books before this, how did you decide at this time to focus on these issues?
I've been a little ambivalent. One, I live here now 6 years.
You came here from where?
From Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Uh-huh.
And I was offered a professorship here, so I've come here. I've been teaching sociology here for these years. And obviously, living here, I've been closely following the United States. I'm also an anthropologist. Wherever I am, I like to engross myself, immerse myself in the culture and participate in the institution and follow the debate. I do that when I'm in Thailand or in Indonesia or in South Africa, etc., etc. So here also. Then I wrote already a book that deals with American foreign policy. It's called Globalization or Empire, in which I dealt with American foreign policy and geopolitics and so on and so forth. But also with questions like Enron, with the character of American capitalism, the American economy. And I was hesitating whether I should devote another book to it. However, Steve, I was asked, conferences, colleagues, collections, to write something else and write something else. So there was material for another book came about.
You have within global sociology probably some specialties. What are those?
My general specialties are studies of globalization, development studies in the sense of international development, economic development in a broad sense, and cultural studies in the sense of studies of ethnicity, anthropological, cultural studies, etc.
And one of your previous books was called White on Black.
Yes, the subtitle of that is Images of Africa and Blacks in Western Popular Culture. Over a period of 200 years, set within a longer period of 2,000 years.
I see. Now, your own background, you mentioned coming here from being a professor in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Was all of your training in Europe?
I studied in Europe, but I also did research in North Africa, in Tunisia. And after studying, I worked for several years in West Africa, in Ghana. I was teaching there. And I also lived or was visiting professor in Japan, in Indonesia, in India, and various other places, South Africa and so on.
And what was your formal education? Where was that?
University of Amsterdam.
Your doctorate?
Doctorate, I studied, I did graduate studies at State University of New York at Binghamton in World Systems Studies, and also at University of Nijmegen in the Netherlands, where a friend of mine was a professor.
And what... When you came here to actually live, that you'd been in New York, but when you came here to the Midwest, you say you have this tendency to be an anthropologist as well and to look carefully at where you are. What were some of the first things you noticed about this Midwestern version of America?
Plain, sober, rather serious, gentle, kind, straightforward, not a tremendous sense of humor.
More religious than what you had experienced in the Netherlands?
By a long shot. I mean, that's so obvious, but that applies to a lot of the United States.
Sure.
By a long shot.
Sure. Let me give the phone number so the listeners may join our conversation. This is a live show every Sunday afternoon from 5 to 6 p.m. here on WILL AM 580. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the host for the program usually, and I welcome people to ask questions, make comments with our guest. Give us a call if you're in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, of course. Elsewhere, if you're listening on the internet, for example, or if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-WILL. And that will put you by phone here into the studio with our guest, Jan Nedervane-Petersa, sociologist at the University of Illinois. Well, we're talking about, is there hope for Uncle Sam? We're talking about some of the problems, some of the difficulties. You talked a little bit about this American bubble that you describe in your book. Tell us more about that.
All right, some of the features of the American bubble that I discuss in the book, and I'll just mention it in briefly and in passing because there isn't the time to go into all of that, is, for example, the enormous emphasis on leadership, cult of leadership in companies, in schools, in academia.
The cult of leadership, that's not something that other cultures emphasize in quite the same way?
Well, Steve, coming from Europe, the first association with leadership that Europeans have, many Europeans, is Germany.
Sure.
And before the war, it was called das Führerprinzip, the principle of leadership. And so for Europeans, many Europeans, they have a pre-war ring. It just sounds very old-fashioned. And one of the slight paradoxes is that this whole culture of leadership doesn't really explain what the others, who are not leaders, actually are supposed to be doing. You would assume that they are actually to be tutored, to be followers, unless the entire society would consist of leaders, which would be unpractical. That's why the culture of leadership, actually is a culture of followers. So it's the other way around.
Sure.
Second thing that is striking about American bubble is the enormous salience and prominence of numbers. Every day brings fresh numbers. Poll numbers, census numbers, commodities prices, rankings, market data, ratings, grades, scores. In fact, entire phenomena are baseball. If you don't like numbers, you're not going to like baseball, do you?
And it's the American game.
All right. So,
but that's true of whether it's basketball or football, too. After the game, what you look at are the statistics, and the individual accomplishments of each player is measured by those statistics.
Yeah. At any rate, the American bubble is a zone in which certain things are ordinary and other things just fall outside the spectrum.
Let's talk a little bit about the leadership issue. That's interesting to me. You talk about it really being a culture of followers. If there's much emphasis on a leader in a company, in an organization, in a city, in a nation, and the danger of that from a European perspective is how that can be abused, obviously, and people can not only become followers but can become sheep.
Well, one step before that, the first impression is that it's just incredibly old-fashioned. I mean, it reminds one of before the Second World War, 19th century. And second, it doesn't really sync with the emphasis on democracy, that is also very strong. These are a bit contradictory. So those things are a bit in tension. It's culturally strange.
Uh-huh. And in this country, for example, in when there's an election going on and people are deciding who is going to be the next, quote, leader, there's all these appeals, which, of course, are measured by the numbers you were just talking about, to the voters to get behind this leader, to follow this leader, to join this, to support this person by your money. Does this not feel democratic from a European perspective?
Okay. I think the leadership principle functions and dominates, one, in corporations, the charismatic CEO,
sure,
who is also paid extraordinary excessively. Second, in the military. The military is obviously a pyramidal hierarchical organization, no question about it. And the military also influences how sports is organized and so on and so forth. So everywhere you have a pyramidal structure and a focus on the top. The American political system is a presidential system with executive privilege, etc., etc. And when Americans diagnose a problem, a social problem, they will typically generate a huge bureaucracy around it, and that bureaucracy must be headed by a czar, a drug czar,
sure,
a poverty, a homeland security czar, an intelligence czar, a war czar, and so forth, a public diplomacy czar. And this continuous focus on the top of the pyramid, it strikes one as quite counterproductive, as actually demobilizing. The leader is supposed to mobilize,
sure,
but actually probably to some extent, you know, the reverse is going on.
So there's less motivation for people to grab hold of an issue and do something about it themselves if they feel like, well, that's for the leaders to make decisions about or to do.
Exactly. All the energy goes into selecting, choosing the leader. And then when the leader is chosen, well, everybody goes home and the field is to the leaders. And that is recipe for trouble.
My field is naturally religion, as you know, and I'm thinking of religious leaders and the kind of expectations and pressures on them in the various religious organizations. And what often happens in worship, for example, in Christian worship, which is what I know best, is that everyone is silent in many, many congregations, and only one person is speaking, and they're speaking from up on high and in a pulpit, often with a mic, with the only microphone in the room. So I'm thinking of the implications of your analysis for religious leaders. Do you see parallels there too?
Two just notes on the side, Steve. One is that it was Durkheim, sociologist, who said that the actual object of religion is society itself. And don't we see time and time again that the actual form and structure of worship and religious ceremonies and occasions, a birth, a funeral, a wedding, a baptism, is the circle that meets, a circle of people that
kind of parallels the larger society.
Yes, and also in the ashram, it's the circle.
Uh-huh.
So the guru principle is one component, one form of religion, but the circular encounter in which the community gathers and actually encounters and meets and celebrates itself and its communion is as much a part of religion. Through religion, society knows and worships itself.
We have a caller waiting to join the conversation on line number 2. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thanks. I have a question for Professor Pierdese and a question for Steve as well.
Sure.
In talking about leadership and religion, I'm wondering if you could give some comments about religion, not so much as a set of beliefs and a set of values, but religion as a kind of mobilized tool, a kind of mobilized tool to advance culture today and to advance politics today. I see religion as being multifaceted in that sense. And in your commentary, it would be great for you to talk about what can be done about how religion is mobilized in the realm of politics today. You know, if it's something that's not good, what can we do about that?
Say just a little bit more before you ring off about that. Can you give us some specific examples?
Yeah. For example, many politicians, or quite a few politicians, will draw on religion and use it as a way to advance themselves as politicians, as I see it. And that religion becomes much more than a kind of abstract set of beliefs. It becomes used in the service of advancing certain kinds of politics. So that's one side of politics, how it's being used to
yeah.
I'm sorry. It's one side of religion,
and
how religion can be used to advance politics today. And you know, what can we do about that as a nation, as a society?
Yeah.
And Steve, I'd like to hear your comments on that as well.
Great, thanks. We appreciate the call.
Okay, thanks. A quick note. One, in the United States, what used to be a major mobilizational avenue was the urban machines. In the 1960s, from the 1960s, direct mail technology became of great influence, and it was through direct mail technology that various religious groups, moral majority and so on and so forth, began to exercise a lot of influence. And the observation is now being made, particularly in the context of the ongoing elections, that the new technologies of YouTube and Facebook, SMS and internet and email and so on and so forth are superseding direct mail and TV advertising, ushering in a new era of campaign innovation and forms of mobilization in which the religion, using religion as a mobilizational tool that you referred to, which of course is, and that was a great tool used by Karl Rove, is still ongoing, but is over its peak. So that's one note.
And since the caller asked for a reaction from me, I have, not being a sociologist, I've not studied this at all, but from reading and trying to be a bit aware of popular culture, it's clear that there have been some changes, and it seems that in this electoral cycle, nationally, the conservative Protestant Christian groups are not nearly as influential as they've been in the past, it seems. I heard an interview just yesterday with one of the people from the National Association of Evangelicals, who was saying that the evangelical vote is not nearly as much a block in this country so far in this election as it was 8 years ago, and evangelical Christians, the conservative wing, is more splintered, and interestingly, I think more progressive Christians, whether Catholic or Protestant or Orthodox, have organized a bit more, I think, in response to the conservative organizations of the past. So, for example, a group that I'm associated with, Protestants for the Common Good, is a liberal or progressive voice in state politics, but also on dealing with some national issues. So I see that as an interesting change over the last dozen years or so. Well, thank you for the call. Let me repeat the numbers for others who'd like to join us. 333-9455 is the local number that will get you onto several lines here in the studio. Elsewhere, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. John, did you have another comment?
Yeah, one further note. Let's combine this with... I'd like to make just one further note on leadership. Combine this with religion, maybe culture. The idea in the United States is that leadership is a good thing. Unlike coercion, leadership involves, has a certain an aura of moral example. Now, it strikes me that in the American case, if you combine leadership with Puritanism and with backlash culture, 35 years of backlash culture, backlash politics and so forth, leadership easily becomes punitive and revanchist. I'll give you an example. The war on drugs emphasizes law enforcement, not treatment, not care. So resources flow to the law and order system and not to drug users as patients who need help and care and so forth and so forth. So while the rhetoric is leadership, the reality is punishment. And this also applies, if we stretch this a bit, to a lot of the role of the United States overseas. The rhetoric is a benevolent, but the reality is punishment. The reality is Abu Ghraib. Now, I come from the Netherlands, where soft drugs have been decriminalized, are legal, for you can buy it for personal use, etc., etc.
Marijuana, for example.
Exactly. And the punitive approach is regarded as counterproductive, very old-fashioned, very 19th century, as regarded as effective, is an approach of care and help and so forth.
How does the Netherlands deal with the harder drugs, cocaine, heroin, things like that? Has that been decriminalized too? I know they're not legal, but if someone is are there laws that put people in jail for using them, or are they put into some sort of a treatment program to somehow try to get them off those drugs?
Yes, that is in relation to heroin, a large methadone program, quite functioning, and people have also observed that the transition from soft drugs to hard drugs doesn't actually occur. Second,
it's certainly not inevitable.
No, indeed. As a major trend, it doesn't occur in that sense. And that by decriminalizing soft drugs, you also take a lot of the edge off there.
We're about halfway through our program here on Keeping the Faith on this Sunday, and we do encourage listeners to give us a call. The professor we're speaking with today of sociology here at the University of Illinois has been on this campus for 6 years, coming from Amsterdam in the Netherlands, Professor Jan Nederveen Pietersse. And we'll be talking with him for another 30 minutes or so. Do give us a call. But he'll also be speaking at the University Wise Friday Forum this coming week, Friday, February 15, the day after Valentine's Day. Do stop by the Y at noon. and Jan will be talking on this same topic. There'll also be a chance for you to ask questions in person at Friday Forum. Friday Forum is a free lecture series now in its, 81st year, I think, something like that, at the University Y. And we have 9 or 10 lectures each semester. This spring semester, the theme is Unraveling Spin and Uncovering Truths. So come out this Friday to hear a talk on Is There Hope for Uncle Sam? And the following Friday Forum, February 22nd, Kathleen Robbins will be talking about creating opportunity through technology. And I mentioned earlier the Protestants for the Common Good. The last Friday Forum in the series will be April 4th. There will be several between now and then. But former Dean Franklin Gamwell of University of Chicago Divinity School will be talking about the U.S. within the world. So again, a look at the place of America in contemporary society. Dean Gamwell is the Shaler Matthews Distinguished Service Professor of Religious Ethics, University of Chicago Divinity School. Coming up also at the Y this week on Tuesday at noon, our lecture series called Know Your University will be hearing from the director of the Illinois Leadership Center, Sarah Thompson. It's interesting hearing Professor Pedersen talk about leadership, and then Sarah's going to be talking about that again on Tuesday noon at Know Your University. Those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith. Next week, we'll be hearing from a poet. We'll be talking via phone line to the University of Delaware faculty member Jean Murray Walker, whose poetry often appears in national and international venues. She's had a couple poems very recently in the Christian Century and been published last year in Poetry Magazine as well as several other places. So we'll be hearing some of her poetry and her talk about some of the religious, spiritual themes, ethical themes in her poetry. Claire Butterfield will be our guest February 24th here on Keeping the Faith. Look forward to her talking about her organization in Chicago. Well, let's get back to our discussion today on Is There Hope for Uncle Sam? What's been responsible for this American decline? Decline in influence, decline in sort of self-confidence, decline in self-image, and many other things. What are some of the sources for that?
Oh, I think, well, this is a large question, but let's make some notes, Steve. One, I think it is the failure of success. The United States has been successful for several generations, have been more prosperous than their parents. And because of this, certain institutions that should be sharp and flexible have become flabby and not used. And one of them is political muscle. When I think of the United States, the three key problems are, one, growing inequality steeply, massively, and not really talked about, really discussed with feeling and depth and emotion in the United States. That's one of the missing themes in the American bubble. John Edwards talked about it to some extent in the elections, but in a very wealthy country, the inequality is staggering, is unbelievable, and growing. And it manifests, of course, in healthcare, in homelessness, and so forth. The second deep problem is the problem of American hegemony, and the way that Americans are habituated, are used to claiming world leadership and world power, and do so in a way in which actually the more global power America claims, the more disempowered Americans become, because the claim to global power really means feeding, sustaining, supporting a security apparatus which for 2008 is claiming an expenditure, if you add everything in, military spending, military-related spending, to, according to Chalmers Johnson, $1.1 trillion. The third problem is, and these two problems interact with the third problem, is the American economy. The American economy is weakening, going down. Why is that? Just to say something, this is of course a very large theme that should be addressed really systematically, seriously, just a few quick points. One, I think essentially a deep problem of the American economy is underinvestment. American corporations, instead of investing in new plants and new technologies, for decades have been tapping and tweaking old value streams. So instead of developing the electric car, they have been milking the pickup trucks and the minivans and so on and so forth.
And the SUVs.
Yeah. And if you compare American products, American companies, say with Nokia, Siemens, Toyota, BMW, etc., etc., then there is an innovation gap. What American companies have done is invest overseas using cheap labor so that you can keep the same technology but with cheap labor can continue making a profit or make a higher profit without innovating. There are some sectors in which the United States does lead: software design, some computer hardware, Hollywood, etc., etc. But they are, and some defense industries, but they are not nearly enough to keep this economy going. What you need then is an active interventionist government that steers education, steers investments, and so on and so forth, and not a government that is simply rewarding offshoring or gives subsidies to Walmart. These are some of the deep interacting problems: inequality, hegemony, weakening economy. And then you listen to the American media, to the American bubble. These are not the problems. In the American bubble, it's all about Hillary Clinton's reaction to this. It's about personalities and numbers and leadership and so on and so forth. Issues that have very little to do with the actual questions that the United States faces.
Do you see a difference in the two political parties in terms of ones that are willing at least occasionally to deal with what you see as the basic issues, the biggest problems facing this country, the inequality, the hegemony, the sense of power and entitlement that we the Americans have seemed to have for the last 30, 40 years, and the decline in the economy? Do you see any significant differences between Democrats and Republicans in at least looking at those issues?
Yes, there are significant differences. There are meaningful differences. The differences, on the other hand, between the Democratic candidates, although they're also significant, are not all that important, not in relation to these issues. Second point, when you go to fundamentals, like what is one of the problems on the world scene is the Middle East. What is one of the problems in the Middle East that the United States unconditionally backs the policies, not of the Israeli people, but the Israeli government? you go to Washington, you find in Washington 100% consensus. On those kind of issues, there is no difference between the parties. When it comes to the claim to world leadership, to hegemony, there is no difference between the parties. On some domestic and social issues, the organization of the economy, yes, there is a difference, not in other issues.
Okay. Let's look at one of those in particular, the growing inequality that from my perspective has, you know, so many serious ethical components. When you look at the growing difference, as you point out, between the rich and the poor in this country, and yet America in its self-image sees itself as very compassionate. But when it comes down to where the money goes and who gets it and who gets to keep it and whose money and power is protected, it's very different from the way we often see ourselves and talk about ourselves. For many years, I worked on a committee that dealt with the homeless here in Champaign County. And it was fascinating to see the responses of government at the various levels to the needs of the poorest of the poor, the people who in this community, this university town, literally didn't have a place to go in the winter. And we had examples of people literally freezing to death in alleys and so on. As we publicized that fact more, and as that was publicized around this country, there were some responses, but it didn't last very long. And there wasn't much help ultimately from levels of government. And yet Americans see themselves as very compassionate people. What's your response looking at this from your sociological
Okay, I think, Steve, that one of the limitations to people's response is individualism. I come from a social democratic society. I was able to do my PhD on unemployment benefits and social security without big loans, right? And when I hear in this country, I hear the discourse from political platforms about taxes. It's your money. You should get to spend it, not government. You should keep it. You should spend it. The you that is being addressed is an individual. But all of us, we are both individuals and group members. The you that is a member of a society, a group, who is perfectly willing to share resources and pay taxes to help people out who are less fortunate, less well-educated, or who have bad luck in life. That too is you. It is wrong that you should only be addressed as an individual. It's a good idea to pool your resources. So I find I pay here too little taxes. Only when I think of, well, these taxes actually go to the Pentagon, I kind of feel sorry. I feel sorry for Americans. Another consideration I have here is that a sense, a hunch that I have here, is that one of the things that has happened to the United States is that Americans have punished the culture of the 1960s, sex, drug, and rock and roll, and protest, and violent riots, through a method of unleashing the market, unleashing market discipline. All right, if you claim a democracy, if government is democratic, if we cut government back to size and we let the market rule you, then you'll learn to be disciplined and not dependent, not the welfare deadbeat, and so on and so forth. Okay, this has been rhetoric, a dominant strain in rhetoric and culture in the American atmosphere, in American ambience. Now, in reality, market forces have walked away with the winnings. They have been disciplining society, but they have become undisciplined themselves. And that is the lesson of Enron and so on and so forth, right? And this is an equation that Americans, through the structure of their discourse and culture, are not able to come to grips with. Well, some people can, like critical economists like Paul Krugman and so on. But the American general discussion, also when you read letters to the editor and so on, isn't.
Let me give the phone numbers again for people who'd like to make a comment or ask a question. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And for listeners who may have missed part of this program and would like to hear it, this will be archived at the WILL website, will.illinois.edu. Go to AM 580 and then check on Keeping the Faith, and you'll see all of our programs from recent years archived there. So if you missed part of this or are going to miss programs in the future live, you will find them there via your computer. Jan, you've talked about these three major problems in our American society, and your book that's coming out, Is There Hope for Uncle Sam, Beyond the American Bubble? Are there ways that the United States can start to solve these problems, begin to correct itself in some way?
Okay. I see ahead, Steve, three major scenarios. The first scenario is, let's call it the crash landing. And what has been happening to the banking system, the credit system, starting with the subprime mortgages and so on and so forth, is part of a crash landing. So we could say that with the United States going in recession, a crash landing is in motion. And out of a crash landing, the United States could make course corrections so that the ship could be straightened. However, if you look at how deep the problems are, you get a sense that the course corrections are tinkering in the margin. So two other scenarios come to the foreground. One is that America can go into decline, but can rise again as a phoenix. Can rise on new technologies. Information superhighway in the Clinton-Gore period, they seem to be on the horizon, and now with green-collar work, ecological turn, a new sustainable America, innovative, smart, e-clever, etc., etc., could arise. I think, however, that this is possible, but I think it will be decades before that is the case, because the present trends are not building a foundation economically and politically to make that possible. And if you look at how Britain led in the maritime commercial phase, and then led as workshop of the world, so it led during two accumulation cycles. Well, the first one laid the foundation, sheltered the second one. And that relationship you do not now see in the United States. So we come to the third scenario. And that is that's also a scenario of decline as hope. It is a scenario in which in which
I can tell it's harder to think of hopeful things than it is to see the problems.
Well, I have to look, it is a new deal. So after crisis, we get via Hoover, we get Roosevelt and a new deal. And there are quite a number, growing number of American economists who are arguing in favor of a mixed economy, returning to a mixed economy with higher wages, stronger unions, and more public investment, etc., a more Keynesian economy. The problem is, however, if you look at the present setup, the politicians, the political culture, the discourse, and the institutions, the elements that make this possible are not there. So what is most likely, sorry to be so dim, but I think most likely is muddling through until the crisis, economic crisis, becomes so serious that the present elites are actually being unsettled and unseated, and a different force field, different forces can come to the foreground. Forces that will say, because essentially the remedies for the United States are not all that complicated or fancy. What the United States should do is dismantle its 800 military bases all over the world, cut back its military spending, and spend more on education and social spending in the country. By international standards, is very commonsensical. If you would ask the majority of Americans, they would probably agree. But now note this. This does not come up in the American media. The American media are the ways through which corporations colonize the American public sphere.
When you talk about that kind of a change in American policy and practice and values, do you see that as being revolutionary?
Yes.
And how far down do we have to go before there's a crash landing that results in those kind of changes?
Yeah. Well, you know, here, I can follow what is happening, but I'm here. I lived here before 3 years in the early 80s, yeah. Right? Now I'm here again, but still, I'm here 9 years. I'm still a visitor, so I'm an observer, and I look also to Americans. Give me your sense of rhythm. What do you think is going on? Because as an anthropologist, you're also listening. So what do Americans say? How far do we have to go for the corner to be turned?
We just have two or three more minutes, but let's bring up a topic that you haven't mentioned yet and is, of course, still current, and that is so much that supports the American hegemony is these last few years has been fear of terror. And we've got to put all this money into the military. We've got to be the world policeman because of the danger of terrorism. Is that real?
Yes, but let's immediately distinguish a sense of proportion, that component that is real, and that component that is threat inflation. It was an American who said that one has to fear, most of all, fear itself. And so threat inflation is itself, in the United States, a major cottage industry that Americans have specialized in for decades and decades. Remember when the CIA said year after year, oh, the Soviet capabilities are this big, that big. And so now a lot of people are saying, why should the Western world, why should the United States be so, make so much fuss about the threat of a flea like Al-Qaeda? There is absolutely no, the proportionality is lost. The United States now spends more on the military than all military spenders in the world combined. Secondly, this is an interesting statistic. The Pentagon spends as much in 38 hours as the United Nations spends during an entire year. Oh. Now we're talking about world government.
You've talked a little bit about what might be involved in hope. Is there any place for despair?
Despair is not a good idea. Decline, essentially, American decline, I think, is principally a source of hope. It is a source of hope for Americans who have felt alienated by war-prone government, because American decline is weakening them. Who have felt alienated by greedy corporations and their market dominance, because decline will take some of the hot air out of that system. Decline increases the likelihood of the United States becoming a normal country, a country among others, which is a good thing, because then a lot of the hot steam, the steam of leadership on a world scale, on an American scale, goes out of the air, and the American atmosphere becomes a more enjoyable atmosphere for Americans.
On that note of hope, we need to come to a close on this program. I want to thank Professor Jan Nedervane-Petersen for being with us, professor of sociology here at the University of Illinois.
Thanks to you, Steve.
His book coming out will be titled, Is There Hope for Uncle Sam Beyond the American Bubble? And Professor Petersen will be our guest on Friday Forum at the Y, 1001 South Wright Street, corner of Wright and Chalmers, this Friday. As part of the Friday Forum series. So you can meet him, ask him questions in person. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs and director of the University Y, which supports these programs. The Y has been on campus for 135 years. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
What would you do if you found yourself in the presence of murderous evil? Would you sell out to survive, or would you resist and try to hang on to your values? I'm Jim Fleming. Maybe you reject the whole concept of evil. Next time, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll meet some people who just aren't sure anymore. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana. A winter storm watch is in effect for Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Edgar, and Shelby counties from Monday afternoon through Tuesday morning. A snow advisory is in effect for Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties from 3 p.m. Monday to 1 p.m. Tuesday. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy and very cold, the low around 1 degree with north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, with gusts to around 25 miles per hour this evening. Wind chills 5 below to 15 below zero.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal; Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana; Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana, and First Federal Savings Bank, Champaign-Urbana. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.